You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are in La Guardia.
Hello and buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of tonight's episode. And as you heard our friend Rob Hatch just say, I am now in Spain. And today I'm in La Guardia in La Rioja Alavesa. Now, today there was an obvious choice of guest. It's the resident wine expert for the cycling podcast. So joining us from Pietrasanta in Tuscany, and the former Leopard Trek team manager and Team CSC, Team Sky and Orica Green Edge communications manager, now bon vivant and wine industry savant, also bike racing connoisseur, we hope for the purposes of this podcast, it's the fanciest Dan on the cycling podcast roster, it's Brian Nygaard. Brian, how the devil are you?
I'm extremely well. Thank you very much. I just got back from the Tour of Denmark, where I worked as a commentator.
How was the Tour of Denmark? We did not hear at the cycling podcast. We did not pay too much attention to what was going on in Denmark.
Well, for me, it's quite exotic, you know, not having lived in Denmark for almost close to 25 years at this point. It doesn't even feel like a homecoming anymore. But it was good racing. It certainly was. And
remind us who won the race. I'm not even sure I can remember who won the race.
Christophe Laporte won the bike race, followed by Magnus Sheffield of Team Ineos and Matthias Gelmoser of Trek Segafredo.
And Brian, were you able to follow much of the Vuelta a España's Gran Salida from the Netherlands?
You know what? To be honest, I actually wasn't.
But you've been catching. You've been revising. You've been swatting up all day, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. And also in the evening, we did full stage commentating of the Tour of Denmark, so it was sort of like my bedtime reading was looking at the classements and getting a bit of a recap, because I knew you would probably quiz me on it once I got back on the pod, so I tried to show up well prepared. And as you know from the Giro, I'm never late.
No, you're not. You're a man after my own heart in that respect. Brian, I'm not sure if you can see behind me. You can see exactly where I am. I'm outside the press room currently, but you can probably just about see the silhouettes of the burnt Rioja hills in the background, the vineyards, or maybe you can just see a Europe car van actually outside the back of the press room. But were you reminded slightly of Tuscany today by the landscape? I'm thinking of the southern Tuscany, you know, out the south of Siena, Montalcino way. I mean, this part of the world, I understand, it looks a lot more yellow and a lot more burnt at the moment than it would under normal circumstances because of the lack of rain.
Yeah, there's a massive drought in southern Europe, northern Europe as well. Most of the rivers are running dry, and yeah, it's quite early that we're seeing this dry landscape. Usually, you know, where you are, the harvest is not until October, and you know, I couldn't zoom in on the vines when you were going through the Rioja vineyards today, but I could tell them, and they're probably also frustrated that ripening is probably happening a little bit faster than they like.
Well, for those who don't enjoy the wine chat, rest assured I've rationed Brian to, I think I'm going to give him 30 seconds in the last part of the episode tonight. So nothing to worry about on that score. Brian, without further ado, we should proceed to the first regular feature of the Vuelta podcast. It is, well, let's hear what it is from Rob Hatch.
El resumen del día a contrarreloj. The stage summary time trial.
So, Brian, others have tried and, well, mostly succeeded so far. I've been pleasantly surprised by the general level in the resumen a contrarreloj, the stage summary time trial. Are you ready, Brian Nygaard? You have 90 seconds.
I hope so, Daniel. I'm starting my stopwatch.
I am going to start mine as well, Brian, and I'm going to ask you to take it away.
So today's stage went from Vitoria Gasteiz to La Guardia, 152 kilometers. There was a very early and successful attack initiated by Lutsenko and De Marchi, and they were shortly after joined by four other relatively unknown riders. They were sort of doing a bit of an arm wrestle with the peloton all day.
A bit harsh.
Yeah, it was a bit harsh.
This is not intended to go on.
No, I see. 6 seconds in and you're already interrupting me. So basically, seeing that Lutsenko was up there and potentially also leading the not just the virtual classification, but also the GC as such, they never really gave them a lot of time. Around 2.5 minutes, I think, was the maximum they got. And as this was sort of a middle mountain stage with a relatively interesting finish for most types of riders, at least the ones who are in shape, it was bound to be caught with around 22 kilometers to go with at the Puerto de Herrera. And actually some rather significant names dropped off at this point. Gesing, Froome, and quite significantly Juan Ayuso from UAE. As the riders were bombing into the climb, it kind of looked like what was bound to happen eventually, that with bonus seconds at the top, the rockification was initiated. And after a short opening by Alaphilippe, you know, you're allowed to be late at the Vuelta, so here I go. So after Alaphilippe was opening, it was quite obvious that the strongest man today, not just on the climb at the end, but also here with bonus seconds were given away, was Roglic. It was a high-speed sort of descending.
Yeah. Time's up, but since we're mates, I'm going to give you a bit of injury time. Carry on. But wrap
it up. Okay, so there was some high-speed descending, including a bit of a acceleration from Remco Evenepoel, but at the end it was all down to two riders who got a bit of a daylight from the rest of the group, and that was Roglic and Danish Mads Pedersen, with Roglic finishing what he started on the climb, and he is now the new leader, the fourth leader from Jumbo-Visma on the GC at this year's World.
Very good, Brian. Excellent. Anything to note on the other classifications?
Yeah, I was noticing, and I was actually also wondering. So now, obviously, Roglic is leading most of the other GC riders within sort of close distance. But Simon Yates, I think most significantly, lost 7 seconds. And he is now, after four stages, already 51 seconds behind in the GC. Evenepoel is 27 seconds behind. Carapaz is 33 seconds behind. So Roglic is currently leading with 13 seconds to his teammate Sepp Kuss, with Ethan Hayter on third with at 26 seconds.
And Brian, any news on the points competition and the Kingdom Hearts competition, or are they just unknown riders as well?
No, they're not. So Bennett is leading the points competition, but Mads Pedersen is certainly closing in. Bennett at 127 points, Mads Pedersen now at 118. He managed to pick up his consecutive second place, so he's still yet to pick up his first win. The King of the Mountains is led by another rider that I've never heard of before, certainly Juan Bo from Euskaltel-Euskadi.
Brian, he's a previous audio diarist on the cycling podcast.
Must have been in the early years then.
it was about 6 months ago. No, it was last year, the year before.
All right, sorry, but I must have been busy. You know, usually the Vuelta is actually during harvest, so maybe it was when I was harvesting in Sonoma the last time. That's my excuse anyways. So he's leading. Youth competition is led by Ethan Hayter in front of Sivakov. Team's classification is Team Ineos in front of Bo Hansgrohe Visma on third.
We didn't need that much of a deep dive. We didn't want that much of a deep dive. Usually stage 20 before we mention the team's classification. But Brian,
I was trying to compensate for my lack of precision earlier on.
Well, Brian, it was very comprehensive, very exhaustive. So congratulations on that and thank you. Brian, it was the quintessential ultimate roglification, a film we've seen many times before. A film I've seen almost as many times as, I don't know, Wedding Crashers or The Karate Kid. What's your guilty pleasure? What's the film that you've seen most often in your life?
Well, I kind of hope that this is... I think it's a bit early that Roglic has the jersey. But it's sort of following his normal strategy, isn't it? By picking up bonus seconds from stage win, picking up bonus seconds wherever he can. And it to me, at least, with him being in this, you know, brilliant shape so early on, it looks like he's building that cushion that could come in handy later on should he have his not usual third week crisis. But he's certainly seen that happening to him before. So I kind of think this was all part of the plan, especially with at Team Time Trial opening the race. So he's building up a GC lead at an early point, and then he's leaving it to the rest of his competitors to try and catch up later on.
Exactly. And Brian, it is something we've seen happen many times before, particularly at the Vuelta a España. But the one doubt we did have this year was his fitness. Obviously, you know, after the crash in the Tour de France, the suspense was maintained right up until last weekend. His agent told me that they hadn't really made the decision of whether he would come to the Vuelta a España. They decided that he would come, and it's looked over the first 4 days as though he has been obviously on very good form. But at the finish today, I spoke to his director sportif, Grishin Nieman, just asked him whether he could shed a bit more light on that decision to finally come to the Vuelta. Also spoke to one of the other sort of unsung heroes of today's stage, a rider we didn't expect to see in the top five, but someone who's clearly going very well, Pavel Sivakov of Ineos Grenadiers. Let's hear from both of those chaps, Brian, shall we?
Well, Grisha, that was the 2019 Roglic, the 2020 Roglic, the 2021 Roglic. Did you have any doubts that was the Roglic that we would see this week?
Not really. I mean, he did have a very, very hard time after pulling out of the Tour, because he did have a back injury. I mean, that's that was not easy, and he couldn't train for quite a while. But we were confident. That's also why we decided on the latest moment, because we know when Primoz comes here, he wants to be competitive, and that's why we decided so late that he's going. And since at the point where he said yes, I want to go, I was sure that he will come here in at least in the form of maybe not in the form of 2021, but in the form of being with the legs of being competitive for going competing for the overall, and that we saw today.
So that last meeting, I think it was last weekend, there was no real doubt and there was no difference of opinion. It was pretty emphatic.
Yeah, I mean, we basically, we always planned with Primoz riding the Vuelta, but he was the one making the last call. He knows how he feels on training, how his body responded to the first hard training sessions again, how his back was doing, and he was the one having the last call.
And did you already get the sense after the team time trial, talking to the guys, that Primoz was very much ready?
Yes, of course. I mean, together with Roan and with Edo, he was the motor in the TTT as well. And but yeah, still, I think also for him it was a little bit of uncertainty today, how he would feel on the first real hard stage. Of course, that stage suited him. So do a lot of stages that are coming. And yeah, we took the opportunity, and yeah, when it came down to a sprint, of course he went for it.
And what do you do with the jersey now, Grisha? You've had it with four different riders already. What do you do with it over the next few days?
Yeah, maybe we try to get another one in the jersey. No, I'm just joking. We have to see. I mean, it's still 3 weeks. Primoz is in a perfect position, and we will decide day by day what we are doing. Like I said, there are a lot of stages shooting Primoz, but yeah, we cannot control and pull back the breakaway every day, so yeah, we have to decide day by day what we're doing.
Pavel, we didn't necessarily think that was going to be your kind of climb today. We thought the team might be well. It seemed to be working for Ethan, but tell us just about that last kilometer.
Yeah, I think it was just because the day was so hard from the start. The pace was really high, and yeah, a lot of guys just suffered all day. I had pretty good legs today and managed to put myself in good position in the last kilometer, and then yeah, just try to follow the best puncher, let's say. And yeah, I think I'm super happy with the legs. As you said, it's not my type of climb, so yeah, it's pretty good to have top five there.
Did you come into the Vuelta sort of knowing that kind of explosive climb and being good on those explosive climbs will be really important, as it always is in the Vuelta?
Yeah, definitely important, but this year I have to say there is a bit less of that, which suits me a bit better. But yeah, of course the Vuelta is always punchy, explosive, and you see Roglic wins it 3 years in a row, so yeah, that suits him really well.
And when he sprinted for those bonus seconds on the penultimate climb, I mean, he looked to us like it was the old Roglic again. And is that what you said to yourself as well, that he's going to be there in the finale as well?
Yeah, definitely, I think for today, yes. But you know, you never know on the long run, in the third week, how he's going to be. How much workload he was able to do between the Tour and now. So yeah, I think might be flying now, but we never know. You know, if he keeps that level, he's going to be really hard to beat. But we never know how it's going to go. It's a long race, so 3 weeks, so we'll see what happens.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Super Sapiens are our title sponsors, and they have also launched the Super Sapiens podcast, which you'll be able to find in whichever app you're using to listen to the cycling podcast. And you can find out a lot more about the system of continuous glucose monitoring, which an increasing number of elite athletes are using to fine-tune their nutrition strategies and get the best out of their bodies. Normally, the podcast is hosted by Zylon Van Eck and Dr. David Lippmann, who is the Director of Applied Science and Content at Super Sapiens. But in the most recent episode, Zylon has been posing the questions to Dr. Lippmann about all manner of things to do with the use of the Super Sapiens system. And in this clip, we're going to hear how different sports require different fueling strategies.
So cycling, pretty much do what you want in terms of logistics, because you've got bottles, you've got pockets, you've got all that stuff. Whereas, and similarly for trail running to some extent, you've got all sorts of stuff. Whereas marathoning might be different, right? CrossFit, they have multiple sessions a day. So really for them, it's about what do they eat at night? What do they eat in the morning? And then trying to get it as much between sessions. And their between sessions is kind of more akin to what we are talking about during, say, a long run, which would be simple carbohydrates, maybe some protein, something like that, because they need to just recover, ready to go again.
Check out the Super Sapiens podcast and go to supersapiens.com if you want to find out more about how it all works and to sign up and start using the system.
The feeling is good, yes, you are enjoying, but yeah, then starting the race, it's always then a different story, so coming to Spain and start racing now. I mean, we will see at the end, we have to see how the race will develop, how my legs will be, just need to be attentive, stay focused, and we'll see.
Well, Brian, a new old storyline in the stage today, and that was an old feature revived from last year, the Daily Rog. We had that a year ago, and it's basically a lot of Primoz Roglic. It's going to be a lot of Primoz Roglic doing what Primoz Roglic always does at the start of stages, saying very little, but doing so in, you know, his usual relatively charming sort of way. I don't know, we've heard it many, many, many times before, and we try to sort of decipher the nuances and to see if we can pick up any clues about whether there's any coded meaning in there, but Rog is Rog. La Vuelta is La Vuelta, and El Diario Roglic will be El Diario Roglic.
There's such a striking contrast between his explosive abilities on the bike.
Exactly.
And how it's just like flickering through a phone book when you hear him talking. It's just, and I was just saying, the States, a big bag of nothing.
Well, Brian, as always with Grand Tours, we come in with these grandiose ideas about how many guys might contend for the race. And I always say that, you know, within a week, it's usually down to two, three or four riders. Does this mean what we saw today? Does this mean that that whittling down process has already started, and within a few days it's going to be Primoz Roglic against not very many others?
I'm not 100% sure. I don't think it's not bad for the race that he's leading and that he has to basically defend from now on. But I mean, there's also, when you look at the riders who are the obvious contenders now, and I think they're quite different in how they will manage their way to sort of try and take the jersey away from Roglic. You know, we still have to see how Evenepoel will unfold as a GC rider, if he ever will. And I think, you know, with the way that, even if he lost a little bit of time today for whatever reason, Simon Yates is still a former winner, and he'll be strong once we hit the real climbs. And Enric Mas is stronger than usual, at least, especially early in the race. So I think there's a lot of interesting perspectives, and I also, you know, you can never say at you know, early on in a Grand Tour race that you can't say that Ineos is out of contention this early. So I think now we have, he's put a marker down. He's Roglic as we know him, but they have a lot of work in front of them. The more work they have to do, the more, I think, potentially the more opportunities will arise once the team is starting to wear down a little bit.
Going in order of the riders you just mentioned, I need to ask you, Remco Evenepoel, are you a believer or are you a skeptic?
Specifically skeptic.
As far, not of his political beliefs, but...
I know that he exists.
As far as his credentials as a future Grand Tour winner may be concerned.
Well, I don't think... looking at him now, and I'm not saying that because I don't particularly hold him in enormous regard. His abilities in the bike are obviously incredible, but he's not someone that I'm yet to take a liking to him. But I will say this: I don't think he'll, from what I've seen, based on what I've seen, I don't think he'll ever win a Grand Tour.
I was saying to a Danish colleague, JP of Het Nieuwsblad, earlier, one of the things that makes it quite difficult to warm to Remco is that we all like an underdog, or we like at least one dimension of someone's narrative to be an underdog story. And as a Belgian, so he belongs to, he hails from the biggest, sort of most passionate cycling nation in the world, not biggest in terms of population or size, but in terms of interest and heritage. So he can't be an underdog on that score. He's been hyped since he was a teenager. So it's very difficult from that point of view, as against a Pogacar who comes from a small, you know, European nation and who joined a team, UAE, that at that time was not necessarily noted for... producing Grand Tour contenders, Grand Tour winners. So, you know, everyone's got something of an underdog about them, but Remco really doesn't have much of that. Brian, you were then going to talk about Simon Yates.
Yeah, Berg, I mean, he's still extremely competitive. He knows how to win bike races, and I think he also knows how to crack the code of the welter. When that year when he won it, he was so incredibly strong in the last week. I think he was certainly on another level than his contenders, and seeing his, you know, I don't really want to talk about the year in 2018, and I know that he certainly doesn't either, but being in a position as a contender and not trying to defend the jersey early on, having Jumbo do the bulk of the Jumbo Visma do the bulk of the work in the first part of the Vuelta, I think that suits him just fine. I think that ambush position is pretty good for Simon Yates.
Losing 7 seconds today is not a good sign, though, Brian. A finish like today, I often say that prologue time trials, to my mind, are pretty revealing because they reveal how much punch a rider has in his legs, which is, you know, often a good gauge of form. And you look at a rider like Enric Mas, okay, he has gone well on finishes like this before. I remember the one last year to Valdepeñas de Jaén, also won by Roglic, where Mas was the best of the rest. So he has a bit of a record on stages like this. However, it signifies to me that someone like him is on great form. Similarly, Sivakov, who we heard from before the break there, whereas Simon Yates, I would expect him to be up there on a finish like today.
Yeah, I mean, but also the finish today was a little bit, I mean, when seeing that Mads Pedersen was second, it was a bit of an unusual finish that almost looked like not a bunch sprint, but there was a lot of elbowing, there was a lot of positioning, shoulders being rubbed. And then you could, I mean, I'm not saying that it's great to lose six or easy to lose 6-7 seconds when you're supposed to be in the GC, but because I think the finish was a little bit almost like a run-in to a flat stage with so much positioning going on. Usually if it's a harder climb where the strongest guys come in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this wasn't exactly it. If this was a really hard finish, Mads Pedersen wouldn't have had anything to do up there. He would definitely overperform, and it was a great finish to see him, you know, contested against Roglic. But had it been a little bit harder, I think we would have probably seen a bit more the real level of Simon Yates. I don't think it was a one-to-one expression of him being not up there in general.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast, Team Car, at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel popping up to tell you that this episode of our Vuelta coverage is sponsored by the Hammerhead Carew 2 cycle computer. While Daniel is hard at work in Spain covering the Vuelta, I've got a different project on. I've been plotting the routes on the Hammerhead dashboard for the second part of our Tour de Cosse cycle tour around all of the Scottish football grounds. Simon Gill and I did the first half of the tour back in April, and towards the end of September, we'll head off again to do, roughly speaking...
Get everything you need for your next project at Menards. Keep your gas-powered equipment running smooth with True Fuel. It's ethanol-free, ready to use, and extends the life of your equipment. Get a 110-ounce jug on sale now through June 14th. Shop our selection of True Fuel in-store and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The Rhythm of the Vuelta.
This is El Ritmo de la Vuelta, the rhythm of the Vuelta, the daily feature where we revisit 1 year, one official song of the Vuelta, and one edition of the race. We're going back to 1980 today, the year of, should I reveal this, Brian, the year of my birth? The official song was Funky Town by Lips Inc. Number one, Brian, it reached in 28 countries. Lips Inc. were a disco funk band from Minneapolis. VH1 years later ranked this song 37 of 100 of their 100 greatest one-hit wonders of the 80s. It's a pretty familiar track, this one, isn't it, Brian? Funky Town by Lips Inc. I think everyone knows it. The Vuelta that year started in La Manga on the 22nd of April and finished on May the 11th. Roberto Vicentini, the Italian, won the prologue and would be one of only two riders to wear the maillot amarillo, the other being Faustino Ruperez, the eventual winner. Ruperez was born in Soria, had trained as a welder before becoming a pro rider, and was seen as one of the great rising stars of Spanish cycling after three consecutive editions of the Vuelta won by foreigners. He was also the Spanish road race champion in 1980, or reigning champion in 1980. He built his success on a stunning solo victory on stage 5 in the Pyrenees to Seo de Urgel. He escaped 43 kilometres from the finish and won by over 3 minutes from Vicentini. He was just 23 at the time, apparently with the world at his feet. The crowds that greeted him in Madrid on the final day were enormous. Reports said 300,000, many of them from the Madrid suburb where he had lived for many years. Only 1 meter, 67 centimeters tall, weighing 60 kilos, Ruperez had the physique of a mountain goat, but the Spanish press believed he was, they dubbed him at least, the Spanish Hino. Alas, that billing proved rather fanciful, and Ruperez's career turned out to be intense, bedeviled by crashes, and rather short. He quit the sport in 1985 at the age of 29, with 31 victories to his name. He went on, however, Brian, to become a DS, and to this day remains the only man to win the Vuelta a España as a rider and a director sportif, having managed Sean Kelly to victory with Cass in 1988. Were you familiar with Faustino Ruperez, Brian?
No, I have to say, not at all. Interesting little fragment of history, well before
little vignette there.
I even knew about cycling, other than getting myself to school.
Well, Brian, a couple of other performances caught the eye today, and I wanted to talk to you in particular about a couple of Aussies. I said that you are our resident wine expert and bon vivant earlier in the podcast. You're also a bit of a resident Australian expert due to your years with Orica Green Edge. Ben O'Connor and Jai Hindley, how did you think that pair was going to fare in the Vuelta a España generally and today?
If you look at them, they're both good symbols of how you can approach the Vuelta, because sometimes it's also, I wouldn't say last chance saloon, but it's sort of the race where you want to do some kind of redemption or reckoning with the season. And that's definitely the case for Ben O'Connor, you know, after his brilliant tour in 21.
As I always say, the Welter's the grubby nightclub that you stumble into at the end of a Saturday night drinking session, isn't it? Anyway, Brian, go on.
Yeah, that's quite... I can imagine that picture very vividly from my former life. With that perspective, it's quite interesting how Ben O'Connor will fare, because he's definitely he's here to redeem himself. He's here to ride the GC. You know, he's still quite a young rider, but already I think with a significant amount of experience, both from the Giro and certainly the Tour. And you know, as of now, he's definitely riding this Welter at a very high level. And then going to Jai Hindley.
Sixth today, Brian. Another guy who's not really a puncher, scattista, but sixth on a very explosive finish.
Exactly. Well, and also, you know, if you compare him to Jai Hindley, who was 10th today, who came in, he's already won a Grand Tour this year. He finished he wrapped up the Giro, where both you and I were witnesses to it, to how he wrapped up the Giro at the very last minute. He's proved himself to be a very, very smart, I think, and pretty overall consistently brilliant in all kinds of terrain, kind of a GC rider. And he's the other Aussie here, but coming in, you know, even, I would say even if he doesn't do great at Welter, his season has still been phenomenal, seeing that he wrapped up that Giro win. But having said that, he's obviously also here, you know, along with Ben O'Connor as an Aussie with him. It's the Aussie ambition, isn't it? So, and he's starting off well. Be interesting. He's got a very strong team alongside of him, stronger than what Ben O'Connor has. But yeah, both of them are off to a good start.
Both Perth boys, Brian. How much of a bugbear would it be, or how much of a source of teeth gnashing would it be at Orica, or what is now Orica Bike Exchange, that there are not only these two Australian riders, but there are others as well. Jack Haig is one of them, who are, well, they probably represent the best of Australia that Australia has to offer, and Richie Porte, of course, in Grand Tours, and none of them are at Orica Green Edge, or what is now Orica Green Edge Bike Exchange.
Well, I wouldn't say that they're victims to their own success in the sense, but the Green Edge project and Jerry Ryan's investment in cycling has lifted the game in general, and has certainly done a lot for how cycling, pro cycling, is perceived in Australia. So it couldn't come as a surprise to anyone that there's a lot of growth coming out of a heightened interest. You know, obviously also with Cat 11's tour victory and then with the birth of Green Edge the year after. I think they already see themselves and knowing that from working with them, that they see there's definitely, you know, obviously a team with an Australian DNA, but a lot of the significant success they have had currently, at least, is based on foreign riders, and they always quite successfully ossify their foreign riders. I remember they called, what did Jerry call Chavez, the Colombian kangaroo. and as we all know, the minute you sign the contract with a team, you get an Aussie nickname. They'll eventually ossify anyone.
Yeah, talking of crushingly awful nicknames, I'm usually guilty of coining those as well. And in fact, I do have one for Ben O'Connor. I, for a while now, have been referring to Ben O'Connor as Super Bock. Super Bock, of course, a famous Portuguese beer, as anyone who's been to Portugal will have seen and probably drunk Super Bock. B-O-C, Ben O'Connor. So Ben O'Connor is Super Bock. Brian, I spoke to Ben O'Connor this morning in Vitoria Gasteiz about his ambitions for the Vuelta a España. Let's hear from him now, shall we?
I'm keen. I mean, after the tour, I haven't done a proper stage for quite a few months, so yeah, I'm excited. I can't complain. It'd be nice to have less stressful racing, hopefully, and have the legs do a bit more talking. Actually, I've only done Basque once. I've been here a few times, but I think I really like this style of racing that comes with the Basque, and actually just the northern Spain with inclement weather and harder gradients and moving terrain all the time. I think that's kind of my kind of jam.
Ben, I was talking to Larry Walbus the other day, and he talks about how motivated you were for this and how well you you seem to have prepared, you've gone to altitude. Just talk a little bit about that, and particularly the period at altitude and the, you know, the mental sort of process of getting ready.
Yeah, I mean, when the tour is done, for me anyway, it was just what's the next thing to look forward to? What's the next objective? And what are your chances? You know, it's probably the first and maybe the only time I'll get to prepare specifically for La Vuelta, you know, without the fatigue of the tour. So feeling kind of fresh of mind because you missed an objective is kind of cool, because then you've come here now even more ready, but in a way without the same level of Tour de France, everything stress and all the shebang that comes with it. So yeah, spent a little bit of time up at altitude in Andorra. It was close to my house, so every second just drive back and forth. It was just like a really nice way to do it. And yeah, it's just been a good mood, so that's about it.
Ben, there are a lot of very different finishes at any Vuelta a España to the Tour de France. Punchy finishes, a lot of uphill finishes. Have you trained more specifically than you would for a Tour de France for that kind of finish, the 2K uphill, 3K uphill at the end of a stage?
I mean, in the end, a lot of the ones here, bar a couple of these shorter ones, are actually quite long. More or less 700, 800 metres elevation gain each time. So what, 25, 30 minutes. So I think it's kind of down my alley. And they're not ridiculously steep, which in the end isn't the worst for me either. I mean, it's all about the length, not so much the gradients that that I struggle with. Yeah, it's more the time. So yeah, it's not the same as the Alps, where you have pretty much like Galibier, Madeleine, and then Alpe d'Huez, for example, quite a fair. It's very different to that. You have always valley in between, but the fatigue will set in because of just the accumulation of altitude every single day. So that's why I can be kind of excited for it, because I think it can suit me. Just need to make sure I do a good TT in Alicante.
Well, Brian, he sounds very enthusiastic, does he not?
Yeah, I think it also really chimes in, and it works well with how the Vuelta looks from the inside and from the outside. And I think that the lack of inherent stress, even for someone who potentially could finish on the podium, it makes for a nice atmosphere. And I'm sure that you can feel that too in whatever kind of mixed zone situation you're finding yourself in.
I can vouch for that, Brian. But Ben O'Connor is, well, he's strolling into the, well, he's positively glissading into the grubby nightclub at the end of the Saturday night with a big smile on his face, and I don't know, and heading straight to the bar, making a beeline to the bar and ordering a round of vodka and Red Bulls for everyone, isn't he? He's has that kind of mood he appears to be in. Brian, speaking of drinking and the Vuelta, we're talking about Australians. You've got a good Vuelta story, or you need to at least explain to me how and why you were responsible for Stuart O'Grady getting kicked out of the Vuelta a España, or sent home from the Vuelta a España many years ago.
Well, it was both him and Andy Schleck, wasn't it? And to the day, I would like to contest that I was at all responsible for that. But I do remember quite vividly the surrounding atmosphere.
Set the scene. What was the backdrop to this?
So the backdrop to this was that it was already a known thing that both Stuart O'Grady and Andy Schleck were leaving CSC, Saxo Bank at the time. And they were moving on to riding for Lippert Trek the year after. But they had already agreed with Bjarne, and especially Andy had given him the handshake of wanting to finish off with a good result in the world. So, you know, we obviously had a great tour, and it at least to me it seemed, and Bjarne definitely confirmed that also to me later on, that they were on good terms. You know, they had common ambitions and they wanted to finish the style. But as can happen sometimes, maybe not so much for riders, but more so for people working at the Vuelta, you do feel the, what was the name of that song, the 1980s song again?
Funky Town. Funky Town.
Yeah, it's sort of like you get that Funky Town kind of vibe. You get caught up in, you know, there's an Aussie saying, if you have one, you have a ton. And I think the hotel that Saxo Bank was at some point in the Vuelta was close enough to a taverna or something that was where they were serving ice cold beer, and one beer took the other, and I think the guy they got a little bit what will you call it? Drunk is probably
carried
a big
away.
Word, but carried away by the atmosphere and the cold beer. And Bjarne walked in on them, and he was certainly not happy with what he saw, and he sent them home, rightfully so, in my opinion. I was at the time setting up the team in Luxembourg, and we all knew once we heard this that it would draw massive headlines in Luxembourg. You know, there was always this context around Andy that he wasn't serious, that he was especially from living in Luxembourg. If you went out on a Friday in the off season, you were very likely to see Andy at one bar or the other, or both of them. And he was trying to shed that image, and that Vuelta deviation certainly didn't do him any good. Didn't do me any good either, because I got, for some reason, I think that, I'm not trying to be a martyr here, but I got screamed at, and must have been my lack of telepathic abilities that didn't make me stop Andy from having his third or fourth Estrella. I was just, bracing myself for the headlines the day after, and I think one of my closing arguments, I think my closing argument to my former psychopath of a boss Flavio Becker was that, well, at least he's starting the off season early, and if he can get it out of his system in September, we could be lucky. He might even actually ride pretty well in February.
Friend of the podcast, Flavio Becker. Look forward to you renewing your membership of the Friends of the Podcast team next year.
With friends like that, who needs
business? Yeah. Well, Brian, you are a resident Aussie. You're also, as I specified in your introduction, you're the fanciest man on the cycling podcast roster. And as... well, the fanciest member of our team, I thought you'd be the ideal man to possibly comment on, well, something historic that's happening at this Vuelta a España. And this brings us to today's Encuentro del Día. Take it away, Rob Hatch.
El Encuentro del Día. The meeting of the day.
Today's Encuentro del Día, today's meeting of the day, Brian, was with the first Monegasque rider ever to ride a Grand Tour. He's riding for Burgos Biache, the Spanish team, the Spanish pro-continental team at this Vuelta a España. He was called up at the last minute when Ángel Madrazo failed a COVID test last week. His name is Victor Longelotti. Not sure how they pronounce that. As I said the other day, I always get slightly confused with Monegasque names. Anyway, Brian, I spoke to him this morning in Vitoria Gasteiz.
Well, Victor, how is your Vuelta a España so far?
So it's been a dream so far. So I couldn't believe I was called by the team to replace Ángel Madrazo. So yeah, I'm super happy to be here, and I'm very enjoying the race every day.
Tell me about last week, because you weren't supposed to be here initially. And where were you? Were you at home in Monaco, or what happened last week?
Yeah, exactly. I was home. I wasn't expecting racing here, so it's been a big surprise. They called me the day before the start, and I just get into the plane straight to Utrecht, and here we are.
And how were you feeling on that plane?
I was just thinking about the race, how I will do on the time trial with the team, and very happy and a bit concerned by the race also. So.
And this year, was this always a plan for you, or an ambition for you to maybe get on the long list or the short list for the Vuelta?
Yeah, it's been the objective the whole season. Unfortunately, I wasn't selected by the team at the first. The first time I wasn't selected by the team, so I keep it positive. I went to Portugal, Vuelta Portugal. It was a pretty good race. I won a stage, so I was in good shape. And when the opportunity presented, so I just keep it like this. And I'm super, super happy, super grateful for all the team to count on me. And
you're the first Monegasque rider to ride a Grand Tour. I know your dad is the president of the federation, is that right? So you probably know some of the history of Monegasque cycling. I mean, how proud are you to take that honour?
No, I'm very proud. And as you said, we are a really small country with only two professional riders. So, it's...
Who's the other one?
Antoine Berlin is the other one. And yeah, it's historical. Last week I get the first victory, so it was the first victory for a professional Monégasque rider. And now, yeah, it's the first time for a Monégasque rider to be in the Vuelta. So yeah, it's very, very special, and yeah, I'm very proud to be that guy.
And people will always be curious, how does someone have a normal life in Monaco? Because the life that we associate with Monaco is not normal. It's millionaires, it's sports stars, it's film stars. What was your life like growing up?
It might surprise you, but my life is completely normal. Of course I live in Monaco, but I live like a normal guy. Nothing really special and nothing really different than a Spanish, a French, or an Italian guy. Of course, we live in a beautiful place with such a prestigious city. But I just live like a normal guy.
And you train with? Do you train with any of the big stars that do live in Monaco?
No, I usually train alone. But of course, when I go training, if I left home at 10, for sure I'm gonna see a professional rider. So we meet a lot of really good riders, of world tour riders. So, but I usually train alone.
And last thing, Victor, what's your dream for this Vuelta a España? It's already a dream to be here, but what would be a dream Vuelta a España for you?
No, as I told you, it's already a dream to be here. And now, of course, I think as a rider, we all want to win. So the dream will be to win the stage. But I just keep it day by day, and we'll see what happens. And I just keep all the positive. For me, it's just a dream come true, and every day is I'm super excited, happy, grateful. Like, it's a dream come true, so I just give it every day.
So Brian, Victor Longelotti from Monaco, curious little human interest story at this Vuelta a España. They're actually more sort of elite sportsmen than people would imagine have come from Monaco, born and bred in Monaco. There's a tennis player, Olivier Boscalier, Olivier Boscalier, played for Nice. I think he still plays for Nice, actually.
So defender. Ineos then, really?
Yes, no, in fact, I think he's been transferred to PSV Eindhoven. He's a defender. There is a tennis player, Romain Arnaudot. There's a bobslayer apparently as well. Victor, as he said there, as I said to him, his father is the president of the Monaco Cycling Federation, so he has grown up with professional cycling. I guess there was a period when the president of the Monaco Cycling Federation was actually quite an important person in professional cycling, because there was a time when, among other things, a Monaco racing license was seen as a way to sort of dodge, get around, circumvent doping sanctions. Nowadays, but that I think that was a thing 10 or 15 years ago.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. You can get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com with the discount code SISCP25. I've talked a bit in the past about the beta fuel, which I used during our ride in Scotland in the spring, and I had the powder, which I mixed up into a drink for my bidons. And over the 9 days of riding, where we were doing around 4 or 5 hours of riding a day, but probably 2 or 3 additional hours of sort of hanging around in the cold, looking at the football grounds and talking to people, not once did I feel like my energy levels were getting down towards a sort of critical point, because I was keeping myself topped up with carbohydrate without really realizing it, just by sipping on the drink little and often throughout the day. I found it a very efficient way to keep fueled without having to eat large quantities of food, which I found benefited my riding as well. Now, since the April ride, something else has come across my radar, which is the Beta Fuel Energy Chew, which is an even more efficient way to consume carbohydrate. Each chew has 46 grams of carbohydrate, and you simply take them out of the packet, pop them in your mouth, chew them, and you know that you are keeping topped up. But be a responsible cyclist and pop the wrapping back in your pocket. No littering the beautiful countryside, please. If you'd like to get 25% off the Beta Fuel energy chews and everything else at the scienceinsport.com website, use the discount code SISCP25. And I should also mention that the energy chews are suitable for vegans too.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Hola, hola. Entonces, ¿podemos ordenar la tempura de verduras para sí. empezar, para compartir? Y después,
la tempura para los dos, ¿bien?
Sí, y después para mí.
So, Brian, la etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer, well, you even heard a bit of me ordering my cena de ayer yesterday in Oñati, up the north of Vitoria-Gasteiz, where I'm staying again tonight in the heart of the Basque country. I was ordering a vegetable tempura, and then they were my last despairing efforts before the vegan diet had to be canned definitively, because well, that duly happened with the main course. I had a very nice, actually, I must admit, solomillo, a steak, and well, I'm afraid there'll be more meat on the agenda tonight, I'm sure. That was yesterday's evening meal. What about tomorrow's stage? What's on the menu, Brian?
Well, tomorrow is in a lot of ways actually a tour of the Basque country. It's very important cycling terrain. You know, there's a big history of cycling in the Basque country, and when you see the start to finish, it's from Irun to Bilbao. I don't think it gets more Basque than this, and anything Basque in cycling is, it's lumpy, it's climbing. I think it's around 3,000 meters of climbing on a 187-kilometer stage. It finishes in Bilbao, and they actually pass Bilbao with just 28 kilometers to go. And the last climb is 13 kilometers from the finish, and that's the second time they go on to tackle that climb, the Alto del Vivero. So I would say it has potential to be a breakaway stage, especially with the way the GC, at least initially, is starting to unfold. I'm not sure that Jumbo-Visma will chase any kind of breakaway for just for the sake of it. Other teams might want to keep things under control. But I look forward to it, especially I think it'll be a very, very scenic stage. We're basically going from east to west on the Atlantic coast, or in the proximity more or less during the entire day, and when we actually also pass St. Sebastian. So it's a small, beautiful tour of the Basque country. I quite look forward to it. It's such a wonderful terrain. It's such a history laden part of cycling to have some good racing in the Basque country.
Brian, as you mentioned, there is a climb that tops out, second category climb, the Alto del Vivero, that tops out 13 kilometres from the finish. And it's a very famous climb in Basque cycling. It's the sort of decisive climb in the Circuito de Getxo, a one-day race that takes place in the Basque country, won just a few weeks ago, in fact, by Juan Ayuso, the Spanish prodigy, who actually didn't go as well as we thought he would today. He looked as though he was suffering on the penultimate climb, and then came in the same group as Simon Yates, so lost 7 seconds. So the Vivero features in that race. It often features in the tour of the Basque country. And in fact, Brian, tomorrow's finale is identical, I believe, to the finale, to the stage that gave Primoz Roglic his first ever road stage victory, or road race victory, for Jumbo-Visma in 2017, a stage of the Vuelta a País Vasco. Finishing in Bilbao, Roglic won with a 2.8-kilometer solo attack. So good memories for him. In 2019, the Vuelta went over the Vivero as well, and the GC guys on that occasion kind of came in together. Philippe Gilbert won the stage. But as you said, this is quintessential Basque country, quintessential Basque cycling territory, isn't it? Fernando Escartín, who's sort of the route designer here at the Vuelta, said it's a beautiful stage, 5 mountain passes that'll be filled with the Basque public. Both climbs to the Vivero, because the race goes over twice yesterday, will be responsible for selecting the leading group. It will be interesting to discover who controls the race, even without clear leaders in the general classification, particularly on a day that's not ideal for the sprinters. Brian, I think unless that break goes away, and well, Jumbo-Visma are pretty happy with it,
and the other teams are pretty happy with it early in the day. It's difficult to see how Roglic is going to lose the jersey tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's other teams that have a vested interest in keeping it together. So it'll all be down to what the structure of the breakaway will be. It's still early, still a lot of fresh legs in the race. A lot of people were probably keen to give it a go. Even as we saw today with relatively strong riders.
Yeah, I think Remco Evenepoel might be one to watch tomorrow. He kept a fairly low profile on that final climb today. He was finished sort of safely nestled into that first group of, how many riders was it? It was 12 riders. So Remco actually finished in 8th place. But I can imagine tomorrow's finale, it's hectic off the top of the Vivero into Bilbao, and there is the opportunity for an opportunist to stay away and gain valuable time tomorrow. So I can see that happening, also because Julian Alaphilippe is still clearly a little undercooked, or he certainly looked that way today. He was pretty well placed actually for the first few hundred metres of the final climb today, and then he faded rapidly. So, sorry, Brian.
One thing that I've noticed with Evenepoel, and I think that could be the key to his approach, is that you mentioned it yourself. It could be quite a hectic finale, and oftentimes anything that's hectic, he wants to approach head first, because he's still not, it seems to me at least, super comfortable by being in the peloton, even in a relatively reduced group, going into a hectic final. So oftentimes he'll give it a go and disappear. And I think looking at how, there's a potential that Alaphilippe could give him a hand. And I also think that what he's learned so far in his, I would say his failures to become a GC rider, is that he will eventually have a bad day. If there's rain, if there's a sketchy descent, whichever. So I actually also think that he would like to go out at some point. And, he's been keeping his powder dry, but we're still early in the race, but I think at some point he wants to start collecting some kind of buffer to what might weaken him later.
Yeah, and just bearing in mind what you said about the conditions, Brian, looking at the forecast for tomorrow, we've got 50% chance of thunderstorms. The storms, if they come, it seems as though it will be late in the afternoon, around about the time when the race might finish. So as you say, he might try to anticipate whatever trouble may come with the weather. That some of the locals, some of the Basques, have also been talking in the last few days about how little rain, as you said, there has been. And when it hasn't rained, I mean, some have said that hasn't been any rain for 3 or 4 months, literally zero. There was actually some rain in Oñati, where we were staying this morning. But when the rain does come and it has been dry, we know the roads, it's typical of what happens in southern Italy at the Giro d'Italia, there's a lot of sort of grime on the roads and it becomes very slippy and it becomes very dangerous. So it could be pretty treacherous.
And especially in an industrial area like Bilbao, it could be one of those a soapy experience for the riders if we get very wet roads to finish.
Brian, I promised you we are in Rioja, the most famous wine-producing region of Spain. I promised you I'd give you not 90 seconds, not the full 90 seconds of the Resumen Contra Reloj, but 30 seconds on Rioja. So I'm going to count you in. We're gonna hear the time trial, the countdown, and off you go.
Well, it's a little bit like, I don't know if you say that in English, it's like asking the devil to read the Bible and pick up the highlights. Yeah, so yeah, it is the most famous wine-producing area of Spain. It's divided into three areas, and you were in one of them today, near the town of La Guardia. It's the Rioja Alavesa. I can just sum up why I don't like Rioja. I think it's too...
Quickly, Brian, quickly.
It's too fruit-heavy. It's too much, way too much oak, oftentimes American oak. And I think the pairing of those two doesn't make for a lot of freshness, which is something that I like. But it's the one wine that people who don't know anything about Spanish wine actually do know. One thing that I'm curious about, lastly, is 10% of Rioja is actually producing white wine. And I'd be curious to taste that, because I don't think you have a lot of tradition for over-oaking white wine in Spain. So maybe that could be the key to my liking of a potential new interest in Rioja, because the red ones you can drink as many of as you want. I'm not going to compete with you in the line of picking them up.
Last night for my aperitif, Brian, I had a glass of the lovely Basque wine that we talked about in the wine podcast that was released on the rest day. In fact, that was yesterday. Chacolí, which I think I pronounced Chacolí in the wine podcast. I didn't realize there was an accent on the final I. Very acidic, slightly pétillant, slightly fizzy, and very interesting. Very much recommended. I mentioned the wine podcast, of course, our Selección de la Vuelta, our six Vuelta wines still available from D-Vine Cellars. Log on to D-Vine Cellars, that's the letter D, then vinecellars.com, and you'll find all you need there to order the wines. I should also say that Stacey Snyder's Vuelta a España mugs, espresso cups, went on sale on Saturday and sold out in double quick time as usual, almost instantaneously, almost sold out before they'd gone online. But that's nothing new. A bit like Primoz Roglic, roglifying the Vuelta a España. Brian, I think that concludes the evening's entertainment. I'm off to have another glass of Chacolí, probably some more meat, unfortunately, because there are simply no options, no other options up here in the Basque Country, particularly because I don't eat fish. Brian, what's on the menu for you tonight?
Well, my wife just texted me that the kids are already sleeping, so I'll definitely be enjoying a glass of chilled wine of my own production, which I've now finally collected and brought back from the Tour of Denmark, thanks to Tim Lindley of Novo Nordisk driving it all the way from Jutland to Tuscany. So yeah, there will be a world premiere of my own wine here tonight.
Brian, I will see you, well, I'll be hearing from you, and the listeners will be hearing from you again later in the week. Tomorrow, we have got Lucky Larry Warbass of AG2R Citroën returning for a second appearance on the Cycling Podcast Vuelta coverage. So we will catch up with everyone then. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Daniel.
And hasta luego.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.